As we announced last week, I've been taking part in our sponsor David Bannerman's Lawyer in the Hot Seat session. That's where his clients and our readers write to him with questions, and being a lawyer, he can answer them definitively. It works pretty well, but we always get far too many questions to be able to answer in the 1 hour that we've got. Now, I'm going to give you the first half hour of this, which covers things like strata roles and email addresses, new strata laws, executive committees, bylaws and permissions for renovations, strata managers acting on their own, and the Design and Building Practitioners Act. Now, that's going to take us up to the first, 25 minutes of this podcast. So hang in there, and we will have even more stuff next week. This is the Flat Chat Wrap.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for attending. We're going to kick off today, Lawyer in the Hot Seat. We will be going through the top questions that keep on occurring through the strata industry. We had a couple of hundred or thereabouts. Jimmy's distilled it down to us. We're going to jump into answering those now. Jimmy's cherry-picked the great number that we had and picked what he thought were topical ones. Thanks again, Jimmy.
I'd like to start with a question of my own, mm-hmm. Because if I don't get it in now, we'll never get it in.
Sure.
So the law seems to say that strata roles have to be made available to the owners, right? Yes. Yeah. And they have to be maintained by the secretary, and they should contain the email addresses of the owners if they have an email address. Am I right so far?
Yes. The strata role is to contain the email address if the person has nominated that they will accept service of notices via email instead of post.
Right.
And that's so where the strata role gets updated. Yeah.
So when the strata secretary says to the strata manager, I want to see the strata role and I want email addresses on it, and the strata manager says you can't have that because it's a privacy issue, who's right and who's wrong?
If you look on our website, getting access to your records is the keywords that you search there. You'll get a good article to give you the answer, which you can provide to the manager. But the strata manager's holding the scheme's records, a bit like a PO box. And if somebody wants to access their records, they're entitled to all records. The only ones they're not entitled to are ones that are subject to legal professional privilege or secret ballots.
Right.
The strata role with every component is to be produced.
Yeah.
Together with all communications, correspondence, and things like that. And you could glean email addresses from communications if they weren't included in the strata role.
Right.
And you'd be entitled to use that email address gleaned from those communications to communicate with people even if they weren't put on the strata role.
Wow. Okay. So what happens if the strata manager says, well, I don't care what David Bannerman says, I'm not giving it to you?
Well, then mediation, NCAT orders could flow. They could ask for a compliance investigation from Fair Trading, or they could ask for an ethics complaint from SCA New South Wales.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much. Moving on to new strata laws. Under the changes to the Act last year, how have the notice periods for general meetings changed, specifically between an AGM and an EGM?
Well, I don't know why they made them all the same. The things that changed was that a first annual general meeting had 14 clear days, and then because it was like a special meeting of new owners and they gave them extra time to get their thoughts together and get their records and be in attendance. And then in addition to that 14 days, they had 7 clear business days for postage if they were serving it by post or if it was by email the day before they'd send it. That then you calculate the 14 clear days after that. But in many strata schemes, not all of the owners have consented to have their notices served by post. And if they haven't done that, they're not entitled to serve the owners via email unless they've consented to it. So I think it was introduced to allow more time across and make it simpler for all general meetings, annual general meetings. The EGM, like the extraordinary general meeting, is still the older time frame. of the shorter number of days, of 7 clear days and the normal postage rules or service by email rules. And they also brought in line neighbourhood associations to have the same period of time as well.
Right.
Being 14 clear days. So they allowed all this extra time. I don't know if they allowed it because more and more people were being served via email and the time period was greatly reduced to sort of like, you know, 15 or 16 days for that meeting to take place because of service via email.
So there's a supplementary question. Is anyone seeing any actual benefit with the new AGM requirements for extra notice?
I haven't heard of any benefits as yet. Like, I'm not sure that it's resulted in greater attendance at meetings.
Right, because it also says that we're getting more complaints about extra notice periods, more owners forgetting, and too much notice. Is that, are you hearing any complaints about that?
I would expect that would be a natural consequence of it.
Yeah.
With people's volume of emails and social media communications, and everyone is expecting everything to happen a hell of a lot quicker.
Yeah.
If you wait for, to allow the proper notice period, you might be waiting, you know, close to 4 weeks with 14 clear days, 7 clear days. You might have a public holiday in the middle there. So anywhere from sort of 22 days or more, how are they going to remember, oh, yeah, that's right, that was on. I could see a result of less attendance at meetings as a result of that.
Well, maybe the answer, I think our strata committee here does the mandatory stuff, but also sends out a reminder, you know, a few days or a week before, don't forget there's an AGM coming up, which would be the sensible thing to do.
Yeah.
All right. I noticed one of the questions right at the end of all that massive list of questions you sent me was, is compliance with the Strata Schemes Management Act of 2015 optional and voluntary?
There's like any legislation, they're broken into two categories. One is mandatory compliance, and they're the main features of the strata legislation. Now, they're not identified in any particular way, and courts often construe whether things are what's called mandatory, which you have to comply with. One of the key features of that's mandatory to comply with is for an annual general meeting, you need to allow the sufficient number of postage days before the 7 or the 14-day calculation commences.
Yeah.
And if you don't allow for that, the meeting can be invalidated because it was the main event of the whole strata legislation. Now, there have been other cases where, say, for instance, when you were engaging a lawyer to do litigation, that you had to follow the right procedure for appointment at a committee level or at a general meeting level, and they said that was mandatory. Now, this was under older legislation. Legislation doesn't apply now. But then when it was also argued that the manager failed to circulate the notice to the other owners, they said that was regulatory and not mandatory, so you didn't have to comply with that.
Right.
Now, the legislation is littered with mandatory and non-mandatory pieces throughout. And sitting between mandatory and regulatory are provisions which identify penalties for not complying with certain provisions of the legislation, leading more to the fact that they're more mandatory.
Right.
Because you can get a penalty that could be issued by Fair Trading. Not that I've ever seen it, but it could be. And that would lean it to be more of a mandatory requirement.
Hey, right. So would it help, do you think, if the government said this is mandatory or this is just regulatory?
I think that would be too hard to do. I've never seen it undertaken for any other piece of legislation. And the same principles about statutory interpretation apply across all other pieces of legislation.
Oh, wow. But, you know, this is something that we are expected to interpret, are we not? Or do we leave it up to you?
Well, it's up to the courts to interpret what's mandatory and what's not mandatory. I can look at precedents and make evaluations about whether it's important. I mean, to give you an example of where it's been argued unsuccessfully, remember I explained a minute ago, like one of the main events is the period of notice for the annual general meeting.
Yeah.
Now, someone tried the same argument because the wording was exactly the same, but for strata committee meetings, trying to say that the meeting was invalid because they didn't allow enough time.
Yeah.
And the Court of Appeal construed that it wasn't mandatory because strata committee meetings are more fluid and more frequent, and they should have fluidity and not have to comply with that period of time.
Wow.
But exactly the same wording was used across both. So give you an indication of about how difficult it would be to
separate. Man. Yeah. Just when you think you've got things sussed, you realize you're standing on quicksand again. I'm going to go for an old tried and tested. It's a couple of people have written in. The upstairs neighbors have removed their carpet and insulation and now exposed floorboards, and the downstairs neighbors are being driven mad. And they say, we've got the standard flooring bylaw. I didn't know there was one, but there must be. What do you do? I mean, your neighbor's running around, especially if they've got kids. They're every time they move from one room to the other, you hear them, they disturb you. You might be sitting watching TV and then thump, 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 thump. What can you do?
Okay, well, this is it's pretty much a never-ending problem. Bylaw disputes. What's weird is the first thing you've got to check to see if you actually have a bylaw that says that you've got to treat the surface of the floor so as not to unreasonably disturb the person below. Because when they introduced the new model bylaws, which were being adopted for strata schemes from November 2016, Fair Trading, for whatever reason, I do not know why, took that bylaw out. So a lot of strata schemes that were registered since that date, which used the model bylaws without extra bylaws put in by the developer at the time, won't have a bylaw to deal with flooring. And a lot of schemes will have a bylaw to deal with flooring. And for those that do, the owners' corporation can issue notices to comply. They can go to NCAP, seek a penalty of up to $1,100 for the first offence, and go to NCAP and get an order that they treat the floor. Or an owner can do that last option, go to NCAP and get an order that the owner treat the floor.
Right. Only if there's a bylaw, though.
Yes. And if there's no bylaw, there's a section in legislation, section 153, which talks about somebody won't create a nuisance that will adversely interfere with another owner or occupier's use or enjoyment of their lot. And so that person who's below would need to rely on an action in nuisance. We've got a detailed article on our website about nuisance. You can type in the words, don't be a nuisance, and you'll find some research that's there on varying cases. And there was more recently a case where somebody quite smartly, there was a problem with the occupier making the noise through the floor. And the standard bylaw that's been produced by Fair Trading only refers to the owner treating the floor, not the owner.
Right.
And so in order to bring their case against the tenant, they had to rely on the nuisance case, but they failed in their evidence. But they started the application smartly, but their evidence failed.
So I'm interested in what was the evidence that failed? Why was it flawed?
It just it wasn't persuasive enough to convince the tribunal member to make an order that this person refrained from doing these actions.
Right. If possible,
to have an acoustic consultant who could measure the noise as to working out whether or not that was sufficient.
Yeah.
As to be an unreasonable interference, because when you do live in strata, you do need to have different expectations about like living in a house. About how you're going to be interacting with noise from your environment. And so you can get an acoustic expert to make some readings about the how loud and whether, in their opinion, they think it's offensive noise.
Yeah.
Absent that, you can create a logbook, and then you can have some independent people who are staying at the property, like a guest, to give a statement that at this day, this time, in this location, the noise I heard was of this type, and therefore, and this is what I witnessed. And then that combined with the bylaw and other evidence, you can prove that the floor's not treated properly. And then they've got to, in order to treat it.
But it's not just the level of noise, is it? Because it's the frequency. You could have a lower level noise happening more often. Have the same level of nuisance for the person underneath.
Yes.
And just I'll throw in here, on behalf of one of my readers, I found this software called Snooper, which you load into your computer, your laptop, attach a microphone, and whenever it hears a noise above a certain level, it will log that. That's and put a time code on
technology.
It.
That could be quite useful in relation to generating a log of evidence for the tribunal to decipher and understand if it, to establish that it's reliable.
Maybe with a name like Snooper, that's going to be harder than you might think. But anyway, it's out there. And I just warn people, don't go onto the snooper.se website because it's got a Trojan virus on it. So go find another. Softpedia is a website where you can download that software. But this this reader said it's actually quite effective. It actually works. I don't know how effective it is in convincing the tribunal, but it's right. What page have you got up now? Right.
Bylaw disputes.
Bylaw disputes. Okay. I'm going to move on to non-performing executive committees.
Okay.
And this is an interesting one. It says, I quote, "I'd like to suggest one related to unresponsive strata committees, which may present an indirect method of responding to some very unfair commentary made recently on the practice in Flat Chat. So a piece of advice, if you want somebody to give you advice, don't start by insulting them. That would be my wee bit of non-strata advice to people. Anyway, basically the question is, if a majority of owners have become unhappy with the strata managing agent and want to apply to the tribunal for compulsory appointment of a new strata managing agent, and then the strata committee says, well, we don't want that to happen, and we're going to pay for lawyers to make sure you don't win in the tribunal, how can that be right?
So each party in a tribunal proceeding is entitled to legal representation. So it doesn't matter what type of order is being sought. It's certainly not recommended to anybody that if they're being sued by somebody that they don't appear at the tribunal or they don't put on a defence.
Right.
No matter what somebody is alleging in the paperwork, if you don't turn up to the hearing, they might submit more paperwork at the hearing and then an order be handed down. So we've written articles about what happens when people just sit around and do nothing, and they're on our website as well. You can't appeal the decision if you think it was wrongly decided. You need to put your best foot forward if somebody's suing you. And that doesn't matter whether you're in the local court or NCAT or whatever court that is. Everyone will have a position that will be different potentially to the applicant's position. What can be done if the parties can agree is they can provide consent orders about something and file that during the proceedings to defuse the dispute from going any further.
Right.
Where there's a multiplicity of parties involved, somebody can file what's called a submitting appearance, which is where they'll agree to submit to the orders of the court on the basis that this person's got to prove their case and that, that there won't be any adverse costs against them from that time. Now, that's in a court process. That process isn't available in NCAT. But you can
right.
Similar, but you'd always be exposed to an adverse costs order at the end of the day, even if you lost the case. I mean, even if a submitting appearance was filed. So it's not just about running a dead defence. It's also being exposed in NCAT to an adverse costs order. Now, just because one person has an opinion doesn't mean that's shared by the other members of the owners' corporation. And if they'd like to defend themselves against the allocations that are made, Section 237 application is generally an application that the committee's not been exercising their functions properly. And the committee may have a different view about that and would like to have the tribunal consider their position about that at the same time as they're considering the other person's submission. So it's really a decision for the committee as to whether they want to engage legal services to do so.
Yeah, I mean, we've had cases recently, though, and one notorious strata manager who he basically had corralled a lot of overseas investors' votes that he was using to stack the committee, and then telling those investors that there was nothing wrong with the building when, in fact, it was riddled with defects and serious defects. And when they tried to get rid of the strata manager, they came up against this thing that the strata manager was using the committee to use the scheme's funds to prevent him from being sacked. And eventually, I think at the end of the day, the strata manager's cabal lost by one vote and he got sacked. and was promptly, I have to add, was then appointed as a statutory manager to a different scheme by NCAP. That's a side issue. But it seems to me that this whole thing is, I mean, this person has said, referred to a majority of owners. If there's a majority, why don't you just hold a general meeting and sack the committee?
Well, yeah, with the new strata reform, you can buy, and you could always do this, this was our view, but they've just clarified to make it that you do not need to have a, you do not need to wait until the annual general meeting to re-elect the committee. You can remove a bad committee member who you don't like just by simple ordinary resolution at an EGM. You can, that's a person so removed can't stand for 12 months. Or alternatively, if you don't like the whole committee, you can seek to a motion to re-elect the whole new committee and the number on that committee at the same time and go for, and all you've got to do there is have 25% of the unit entitlements, and that'll be enough to require that the secretary of the scheme convene a meeting with the relevant motion that you've provided as soon as reasonably practicable, and then you can seek to vote in the whole new committee or remove a particular member.
On that same topic, can you, at that meeting, change the number of people in the committee?
Yes, I can't. You can really. There's nothing. Where there was an element of confusion, was it because the AGM notice said that you must have this as an item at every AGM? Some people thought that that was the only time that you could consider that motion. The legislation never said that you must do it at the AGM and nowhere else. So they never went as far as to say and nowhere else, e.g. an EGM.
Right.
And that's still the position now.
So you can go to an EGM and say, look, there are 7 people on the committee at the moment. We want to reduce it to 5.
No, and we want to have. You'd have to put up a motion like you would to vote on the number, and then the meeting would vote on the number, and then you could consider the nominations. And if you've got more candidates than nominations that were determined at the meeting, then you do a ballot.
Right.
And keep the ballot down.
And that ballot is a poll vote, isn't it? It's not just a show of hands.
That ballot is a you can do it by it depends on how the meeting's being run. If it's a Zoom meeting and you've got people there via Zoom, well, then people can do ballots with the online voting platform that they've got. So it'd be that they have spots where you can complete the ballot online and submit the ballot through. But typically the ballot will need to be in writing because you've got to nominate in writing somehow, whether electronic or otherwise, the vote of the, say, if there were 7 nominations and you've only got 5 people, you've got to write down on some format, whether paper or electronic, who is your top 5.
Right.
And then the secretary receives the ballots. They count them as count out who has the majority, and then they'll announce the majority. And then if somebody wanted to then call a poll vote to calculate it on unit entitlements as opposed to a show of hands, and somebody would call poll vote, but that would need to happen before they moved on to the next motion, and then they would recalculate those votes cast based on unit entitlements, which might turn the outcome of the election.
All right. Okay, that's the first half of Lawyer in the Hot Seat, and our thanks to David Bannerman for inviting us onto what is essentially his webinar. Next week, we will be looking at a variety of topics, including bathrooms and flooding and stuff like that, retaining walls, disputes with councils, and more bylaw disputes. Thanks for listening, if you have been. And we'll talk to you again next week for the second part of Lawyer in the Hot Seat.
Thanks for listening to the Flat Chat Wrap podcast. You'll find links to the stories and other references on our website, flatchat.com.au. And if you haven't already done so, you can subscribe to this podcast completely free on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcatcher. Just search for Flat Chat Wrap with a W, click on subscribe, and you'll get this podcast every week without even trying. Thanks again. Talk to you again next week.